Hello and welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the podcast for people who want to keep up with the news, even when, frankly, it feels like surely the news cannot be real, especially in the sense of what we're talking about today. But more specifically, this podcast is designed for people who don't feel like they have the time or don't feel like they have the capacity to follow everything that's happening all the time and every latest development, because I get that this stuff moves very fast. So I'm going to just strip it all down, put it in one place and make it make sense. I'm Julia Bell, and today I cannot believe I'm going to do this, but I'm going to talk you through the UK's latest policy on quote unquote illegal immigration, which involves sending some asylum seekers, people seeking asylum, to Rwanda, as in Rwanda, Africa, as in, I've Googled it, 7,000 kilometers away. So instead of processing these people here and deciding, you know, whether to then grant them asylum, should they be eligible or freedom to stay in the UK, the place that they journeyed to, instead of that, they'd be sent from here once arriving to Rwanda and then processed there. But the kind of key to this here is it's not just a processing centre in Rwanda. If they were to be granted asylum, that is where they would stay and be resettled in Rwanda, despite kind of aiming to come to the UK. It's like we're offshoring this whole operation, and I mean the word offshoring incredibly seriously, because Rwanda is, and I cannot stress this enough, so very, very far away. I've just not heard of this being a thing before. I couldn't quite believe it was a real policy at first. But what I'm going to do in this episode is explain what we do know about it, because we're still kind of gathering information about how it'll work in practice. I'll talk you through how the government are saying it will work, also some of what the costs might be or what some of those projections are, and then we can talk through kind of the government's justifications for it versus the criticisms of it, of which I'm sure you'll be unsurprised to hear there have been bountiful. By the way, I'll also mention that I caught up with Rahana Popal, who is a barrister specialising in human rights, which is, of course, a huge part of this topic. And I essentially just asked her, is this concept even legal? What are the legal ramifications of this? So I'll share that very informative chat with you in this episode as well, which will offer you that all-important legal perspective on such a kind of relatively unheard of policy, frankly. So with that said, make sure you're subscribed to this podcast. You just have to click follow or subscribe, depending on what platform you're listening from. And that means you'll never miss an episode. And also, if you find these podcasts helpful, please do give it 5 stars. And that means that other people will be more likely to have a listen as well and join the community. Okay, with that said, let's break down what on earth this scheme, this idea, this policy is all about. Okay, so on the 14th of April, the government announced this new plan that will see some asylum seekers potentially sent to Rwanda instead of having their claims processed here in the UK. Can we start? I think, first of all, it's probably best to just hear it from the horse's mouth. The horse's mouth being Priti Patel, because this is her baby, really. She's the Home Secretary and this falls under her remit. And this is how she described to Parliament how the agreement might work when she stood at the dispatch box in the Commons.
And just last week, I signed a new world-leading migration and economic development partnership with Rwanda. Under this partnership, those who travel to the UK by illegal and dangerous routes, including by small boats across the Channel, may be relocated to Rwanda, where they will have their asylum claims considered. Those in need of protection will be given up to 5 years of support, including education and employment training, help with integration, accommodation, healthcare, so that they can thrive there, Mr. Speaker. The UK is supporting this investment in Rwanda over 5 years, boosting the Rwandan economy and increasing the opportunities of people living there, further cementing the trading and diplomatic relationship between our countries.
Okay, Priti Patel there, and like I say, you know, she said it how I said it. Those who arrive, quote unquote, illegally in the UK may be sent to Rwanda to have their asylum claims considered there. And of course, you heard her saying that, you know, the point would be for them to stay and be granted work and education and healthcare and have the opportunity to, quote unquote, thrive. But the idea is that it's effectively a one-way ticket. You know, it's not like they could just come back and it be transitional. That's it. Once you're there, you're there. That seems to be the point. So this could affect anyone who comes to the UK via a quote-unquote unofficial route, as opposed to what the government describes as a safe and legal route, right? So they have this scale of legality when it comes to how people get here. So for example, if you take the Afghanistan and the Ukraine resettlement programs, those are government designed, government approved, you know, stamp of approval. We know you're coming. We've planned for you to come. We've facilitated your safe passage to get here. But it's safe to say that not everybody gets the privilege of that, frankly. Some people are escaping from horrific conditions, but they aren't able to access that kind of a scheme, which is likely an explanation for why huge groups of people do attempt to get to the UK via dangerous and technically illegal routes. Like, you know, for instance, the things you see where people are getting into small boats and dinghies trying to cross the English Channel, or stories you hear about people piling into the back of lorries and sneaking over the border that way. And I mean, it's difficult to know how many people this policy could affect. In theory, tens of thousands, just judging by A, how few official or legal routes there actually are for asylum seekers to get here, and B, by just how many people do get here by what's described as illegal routes. You know, the BBC estimated that last year, 28,000 people arrived in small boats, just in that method, across from the English Channel, which is around half of all UK asylum applications arrived that way, which of course the government deems illegal. So in theory, would all of those people be put onto this kind of a scheme? Which would mean, what, are we going to see tens of thousands of people ending up on flights to Rwanda? This is kind of the question that's being posed around this. And what we do know is that this could start applying to anyone who has arrived in the UK since the 1st of January, which is months before the policy was announced, because, of course, it was announced in April. And it also seems to be the case that there's no cap on the number of people who could be sent to Rwanda. I don't think the government have necessarily put a limit on that. Now, you'll have loads of questions, and I'll try and get through as many of what they might be as possible. But one key question might be, what do Rwanda have to say about this? What do authorities and the top brass there have to say? What's their perspective? Obviously, you heard Priti Patel talk about this being an agreement that was reached. And in that speech, she kind of talked about it being bespoke, as if it was mutually designed by both the UK and the Rwandan authorities. But on top of that, what we also know is that the UK has paid Rwanda an initial £120 million, which will go towards the costs of processing all these migrants and asylum seekers, and also towards, you know, education and resettlement projects on the ground there. Beyond that, in terms of cost, very few details have been given to us about what the total cost of this whole scheme might be. In fact, according to the BBC, Priti Patel was warned by senior civil servants in the Home Office, in her department, that this deal didn't represent good value for money. So it's dead expensive, in other words, and not really worth it. And so because of that kind of friction from within Whitehall, from within her own department, Priti Patel had to personally approve the scheme using a special power called ministerial direction. A ministerial direction, which is essentially an overruling of official advice from the senior civil servants within her department. A ministerial direction where it's a sort of I'm intentionally ignoring that advice and going ahead with this thing that I want to go ahead with. So that, as a concept, using that ministerial direction power, is rare. I can't stress to you how rare it is. In fact, I think it's the second time it's been used in about 30 years within the Home Office. Anyway, sorry, the question wasn't actually about money. It was about the Rwandan perspective on this. What's their view on it? And from within the top tier, you know, the authorities in charge, it seems it's very positive. The Rwandan Foreign Minister, Vincent Biruta, has said that Rwanda is pleased to work with the UK, and they have kind of claimed or confirmed that the country does indeed have the capacity to receive this level of migration. And this was at this press conference in Rwanda where Priti Patel visited, and they were, you know, signing this deal and celebrating that. And it was revealed that Rwanda will build new infrastructure to educate and train and house the migrants that are sent over from the UK with the UK's support. So there you go. That's the kind of bare bones of it, and how the UK are putting it and how Rwanda are feeling about it, at least from an authority point of view. But I'm sure at this point you're asking, as I was, can you actually do this? I mean, is it legal? Is this a real thing? The Home Office believes it absolutely is, and it, you know, it can be justified legally. But it does sound like Boris Johnson is at least expecting these plans to be challenged in the courts. Take a listen to this.
We expect this will be challenged in the courts. And if this country is seen as a soft touch for illegal migration by some of our partners, it is precisely because we have such a formidable army of politically motivated lawyers who for years have made it their business to thwart removals and frustrate the government.
So that was Boris Johnson there, somewhat kind of anticipating some pushback. And on this legality question, that's where my knowledge ends. You know, I've never seen a policy like this before, really, and I'm certainly no legal expert. So with that in mind, I caught up with human rights barrister Rehana Popal. She is intimately familiar with UK law as well as international law when it comes to how we can treat people. And I started off by asking her the question that I've maybe posed five times already on this podcast, which is this legal?
It all starts, first of all, with the Nationality and Borders Bill. So through the Nationality and Borders Bill, that now gives the government the power in order to remove asylum seekers to third countries. The policy on how they're going to do this, or what will be the criteria, we don't know.
Okay. So basically, they've introduced a law that allows them to then introduce this law. It's like they've got a little strategy.
Yes. So they need to do, so this is step one, but the biggest step, if you want to put it like that. So the biggest step, which is we've now gone through the House of Commons, and it means the Nationality and Borders Bill has passed. Therefore, in theory, the government now has the power in order to remove asylum seekers to third countries. However, all of this will be governed by policy, because policy and law go hand in hand. You have the law, and then you have immigration policy, which dictates how that law would work. Mm. We don't know what that second part is yet. It's also
so they've just announced like a broad brush. We're going to send people who don't belong here or don't deserve to be here, don't have the eligibility to be here. We're going to send them to Rwanda, but they haven't written out the fine print for us to examine yet. Is that what you're trying to say?
That's exactly it. So what they did do, if you remember a few weeks ago, there was that policy announcement. There was that press conference with Rwanda and Priti Patel, and then they published a memorandum. That is not yet a policy. That was just the absolute bare bones of the kind of the most broadest, the most vague of intentions. Mm. We are still waiting to know what their policy is, so we can say, okay, well, this is how it's going to be applied. Now, we know they don't want to give it to us. And I believe it was in the House of Commons that Priti Patel said, well, if we publish this early on, then lawyers are going to get their hands on it.
So fundamentally, you can't pick holes in, as a human rights barrister, in the concept of sending refugees to another country, because it's law. That bit is signed, sealed and delivered kind of thing. It's more the how are you going to go about this? What does it involve? What's it going to cost? How are people going to be treated? And also the element of them going to Rwanda. That stuff, maybe there's some grey areas that you could pick out, but we just don't have enough information yet.
Yes and no. So again, unfortunately, with all lawyers, you never get a straight answer out of any of us. We have fundamental obligations. So in other words, we have fundamental rights. We have the European Convention of Human Rights, which is enacted in law again through the 1997 Act. That is in Britain. And unless Parliament applies to repeal it, any law must be compatible with it. So, for example, our right from freedom from torture, our right to a family life, Article 6, equality of arms, right to fair process, to trial, to a hearing, all of that is also entrenched in law. Sometimes the courts can strike down parts of provisions to say, actually, this is incompatible with our laws, or what you've passed doesn't work with this particular law, this particular other law, because the two don't work together.
Yeah.
But the application of how these laws work, again, is partially down to policy. Policy plays a huge role in this. In other words, if it says, for example, and this is a crude example, so let's just say the Home Office published a policy and says, anyone who enters the United Kingdom via a small boat will be removed to Rwanda within 12 hours of arrival, regardless of race, gender, colour, nationality, whatever, without any assessment, they will be removed. You could say, well, hold on. What happens if it's a victim from torture? What happens if this is a person who's subject to human trafficking? What happens, in fact, if in the interim that person has a medical emergency? Will you still be? There becomes a whole load of other issues that arrive from the application of that policy within, which make it incompatible with other wider laws. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like hand in glove. So if the government were to produce a policy and roll it out, make it real, yeah, and then you were to go, ah, alarm bells, that contradicts a much longer standing, more entrenched law that we have and that we're all okay with, you can't do that one. Yeah. So, and that sort of stuff could arise as we gather more information about how the government.
Exactly. So for example, they can say, we're only removing single men, right?
That does seem to be the focus. The chatter is that the focus will be on single men.
So will that not be discriminatory? We have equality laws.
Right. Right.
Why are men given less preferential treatment to women?
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
So that's grounds that some lawyers could start kind of latching onto.
Exactly. And that's the kind of stuff which Preeti Patel doesn't want to publish her policy, because that's exactly the kind of issues which we all most lawyers, I think, whichever side you're on, and whichever, both all barristers and all solicitors who I know in this industry, look at this and say, this is legally incredibly difficult. The application of this is going to be really hard, because there are certain constraints in which regards whatever the government wants to do, but there are certain constraints that they'll have to conform to unless they're intending to ripping up all the rule books. But that, again, takes time. You can't just decide to repeal a law overnight, or to say, actually, equality doesn't apply to immigrants. This is why the policy is so important to determine, actually, well, is it applicable to our wider laws, how they want to apply it.
And is that the lens that you look at this through, the national laws that, you know, we've abided by for, you said 1997 was the particular kind of rule book you were referring to there, but I'm sure there's a multitude that this could potentially contradict. What about the international lens then? Is there anything that you're aware of in international law that says this isn't okay, or perhaps that isn't your remit?
You know, so what a lot of people don't know is our entire asylum system across the world is underpinned by the Refugee Convention 1951. It was introduced on the back of World War II. After the atrocities in World War II, the international community came together and said, never again. And actually, we need to be able to create safe mechanisms for individuals to seek protection when they're persecuted, when they're removed forcibly from their country. And that was the basis and the foundation of our asylum system. So you need to look it back into the context of what happened in Europe in the 1940s. That was what led to the idea that it doesn't matter on what means you enter the country. It doesn't matter if you enter the country illegally, because again, put it into the context of 1943, for example, if you had a Polish Jewish family who has just fled from the Nazis, they may not have the ability, or probably did not have the ability, to grab passports, go to an embassy, ensure their documents are stamped in order to wait into a queue in order to come to, for example, the United Kingdom, where they may have had family members here already. They would have just fled.
Yeah, got here however they could. Which is what a massive portion of the people that, you know, are going to be involved in this could be described as people who have fled from horrificness.
Exactly. And this is why the Refugee Convention was designed in such a way where it does not penalise those who enter clandestinely. That's the term that's normally used. That means illegally, through unlawful means, as the government likes to call them, but that have just entered into the country. And also doesn't mean it can't prosecute or doesn't penalise individuals for entering without legal documents. That was the whole basis behind it. And
an international law.
Yeah. And one that we are signatories to. And what the Nationality and Borders Bill does is saying, actually, we're going to opt out of this bit. We're going to opt out of this part.
And it actually explicitly says that sort of cherry picks areas of international law that it's going to ignore.
Yeah. And the problem with that is it now sets an incredibly dangerous precedent. The precedent this sets is so dangerous. And yes, the rest of the world will probably be looking at us.
Can I ask if there's legal precedent for this? You said that other countries are going to be watching on, and I imagine you're absolutely right. But do other countries already do this, send refugees or people seeking asylum abroad?
The closest we get is Australia, and that's the Nauru Islands. These are islands off of Australia in which they send back or migrants who are still in international waters or are intercepted and put onto this island. Now, the humanitarian record of Australia is poor. It's been internationally heavily criticised. There are children who have been born on that island and have lived there their entire life in what is called conditions that are close to destitution, abject poverty, lack of education. There is no infrastructure there, and the government leaves. And those individuals also don't have the option to even say, send me back, I'm done.
So this is the same idea. It's people who have tried to get to Australia who are trying to migrate there illegally, and they're getting sent away to a different country without their consent because they're kind of being claimed to break the law.
Yeah.
Okay.
The difference between us and Australia is we're signatory to the Human Rights Act. They don't have a Human Rights Act. Therefore, the idea that Nauru could even exist in our world would not happen.
Is this historical? This isn't happening now.
No, this is now.
Okay.
This is now. Nauru Island is now. And these individuals come back who do get off the island are there with severe PTSD, severe mental health after the end of this process. And it costs the Australian government hundreds of millions. And it's only a tiny little population. And there's been such criticism of it because it's not deterred migrant crossings. It's been highly costly for the government. It's also then cost them even more money in further litigation brought thereafter. And the idea that we're now copying it, knowing that it was such a failing process, that even the government of Australia is going, that one ain't working. And now we're going to go, hey, we've got one better. Let's send them to a country which formerly had a genocide in it. That's a formula for success.
I mean, this is the thing, though, because, you know, the government's response to that kind of thing so far has been Rwanda's human rights record is good, maybe not record historically, but current. And, you know, they'll welcome these refugees and they will integrate them. And this is going to be positive for everybody involved. Would you refute that idea?
Yes. Whilst I applaud Rwanda on one hand, and I do not want to take away from its absolute positive. It has made huge positive strides in the last 20 years to get from where it was to where it is now. And that's positive for Rwanda. However, its record on government in transparency and corruption is very problematic. And then it raises questions, for example, LGBTQ laws. Rwanda does not have a wonderful record when it comes to LGBTQ rights. So what happens if we're now removing an Iranian gay asylum seeker from Iran? He's rightly fled, and being gay in Iran is a floggable offence, one that carries a death sentence potentially. And then he comes to the UK, he's a single male, and then within 12 hours or however many hours, he's then removed to Rwanda, which does not also cover LGBTQ asylums or does not have the positive record. What then? Will they then pay another agent? They call them traffickers. And I think there's always a difficulty with that term. Will they pay another agent? Do they make them cross borders illegally or in order to get to another safe third country? Because actually the one that they were shipped to doesn't recognise them as an LGBTQ asylum seeker, what will that person then do? It creates a very vicious system. And the whole purpose, and you go back and you look at what was the purpose to why this system was created? Why did we have the Refugee Convention? The purpose was that when you have migration from people who are fleeing persecution, you want to give them safety and certainty. And in fact, the Nationality and Borders Bill and this Rwanda policy removes both legs of that. They give them no certainty nor safety. And it raises serious question, in fact, if this even complies, even with the spirit of what was once a fair, well, what should have been a fair asylum process, because there's now basically no mechanism for it.
Yeah. Although I understand that the problem that the government are trying to deal with is, on the day that I'm chatting to you, at least 600 asylum seekers made it over from Calais to the shores of the UK in boats in a day. And the government are projecting that it could go up to 1,000 a day. And, you know, naturally, the government is going to say, we got voted into power by a portion of the population who feel our borders are too loose. How do we tackle this problem? We can't keep accepting everybody. So what would your, response be to that?
The problem is the government's reasons to why it has a problem with this is the cost as well. And I understand the cost elements of this. The system is created to be costly. We all know detention centres are not effective. And in fact, they're incredibly costly if you're trying to manage migration. What you should do is make them live within the community, which is far less costly.
Integrate people. Just accept it, yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Second of all, we then deal with the whole issue of migrant crossing, and the government, or particularly this government, would like to heavily blame human traffickers. The reason why, and I'll use a quote, which is, necessity is the mother of innovation. The reason why these individuals exist is because there is no lawful way, again, for them to come to the UK. If it was the case that they open up an asylum processing centre,
in France,
and in other words, you process asylum claims, you deal with them, you accept those who are eligible, and you bring them in a lawful and safe way, and you reject the others, why not?
Okay.
France is open to the idea. Why wouldn't Britain do it?
So the dangerous getting into boat stuff, you think that only exists because we don't allow any other way? Just quickly, because I know we're running out of time. Is there surely not such a thing as a UK that is just too full? Not enough school places, not enough roads, not enough hospitals. How, if your policy is, let's just allow it and integrate them, is there no cap on your vision for what a fair asylum system would look like?
Of course, but most people get really overwhelmed and say, actually, thousands of people, etc. The numbers are absolutely tiny. I mean, they are an absolute drop in the ocean, I believe. In last year, it was something in the region of about 26,000. We have over 100,000 that move in migration, that we come through visas, etc. Things like, okay, well, let's do an agricultural visa in order to get fruit pickers. Let's go to India and strike a deal in order to get more people who've graduated from university to do more technological work. Let's go to Singapore to try and recruit people from over there. The idea that Britain is full is simply not plausible, particularly when we're looking to the international world to say, hey, can you fill up our vacancies in our NHS? Can you please come here and be nurses over here? By the way, we're also running out of fruit pickers. For example, I'm representing an individual who's a qualified doctor, and I represent another individual who's a qualified engineer who's come from Afghanistan, didn't study in Afghanistan, actually studied in one of the top universities in India, and then came to the UK and claimed asylum and is now languishing in a hotel when actually he's highly skilled, speaks fluent and perfect English, but is not allowed to take a job, is not allowed to work, not allowed to seek employment, not allowed to open a bank account, all because we wanted to create a hostile system. Would it not be far simpler to say to this person, okay, it's unlikely you're going to be removed in these circumstances. So whilst you're here, you need to pay your own way. Go get a job. And by the way, here's your paperwork. And by the way, we can also tax you when you're working. Why on earth does it make more sense to us to say, no, we're going to cut off our own nose to spite our face and you're going to stay in a hotel? and then be annoyed that we're then paying for their hotel bill.
Right. How does that so you think this is just a lot more about a narrative of a specific group of people?
Yes. Yeah. I think if anyone was looking at the wider kind of economic arguments, it doesn't stack up with that idea. And again, I'm not saying, and I absolutely make clear, we need to have a system that works. In other words, there may be individuals who are not eligible, who can safely go back to their country. And actually, if you had a system that properly and effectively worked as a filter, it makes it a lot harder for people like me, for example, to turn around and challenge that. If the government wishes to criticize lawyers, I think what it could do is be better themselves. It will be harder for us to be good.
Love that. It's not me, it's you. That's the Rahana approach. Listen, I'm aware of time, so I want to let you go. But thank you so much for talking to me today.
You're very welcome. It was an absolute pleasure.
Rahana Popal there, really helpful to gain her kind of legal perspective, and she certainly didn't hide her total disdain for this scheme. But, you know, with criticism from what I've seen to be many voices on the legal side of things, I still think it's important to outline to you what the government are saying to justify it. You know, could this be a surprisingly successful endeavour in at least deterring people from opting to take on these kind of treacherous, dangerous, and sometimes fatal routes to get to the UK? Is the threat of being sent 7,000 kilometres away to Rwanda potentially enough to put people smugglers out of business, which is something that Priti Patel has clearly stated is a massive priority for her in government? Well, this is how she justified it. This is what she said.
This government has done more than any other in recent history to support those fleeing persecution, conflict or instability. But we cannot focus our support on those who need it most or effectively control our borders without tackling illegal migration, which, Mr. Speaker, is facilitated by people smugglers, serious organised criminals that profit from human misery, who do not care about people drowning in the channel or suffocating in the back of containers. We must break their lethal and evil business model by removing the demand for their repugnant activities. This type of illegal migration puts unsustainable pressures on our public services and local communities. Every day, the broken asylum system costs the taxpayer almost £5 million in hotel accommodation alone. The cost of the asylum system is the highest in over two decades at over £1.5 billion. And as the Prime Minister, Mr. Speaker, said last week, our compassion may be infinite, but our capacity to help people is not.
So there you go. Patel's main argument is that the current model, where, like I say, people can claim asylum once they've reached UK shores, even if they've done it illegally, she kind of argues that it almost actively encourages the business of people smuggling, and it's that which is leading to tragic incidents. And since the number of people making that crossing is going up, but almost every day, expected to get up to 1,000 a day in the next month, according to the BBC, the government are kind of putting this out there as, you know, this Rwanda thing is our ultimate putting our foot down kind of measure. And I suppose it's important to look into what the opposition are saying, even though I reckon you could guess. But this is what Keir Starmer, leader of the opposition, had to say.
I think we need to see these plans for what they are. It's a desperate announcement by a Prime Minister who just wants to distract from his own law-breaking. You know, they're unworkable. They're extortionate. They're going to cost taxpayers billions of pounds. And they just reflect a Prime Minister who's got no grip, no answers to the questions that need answering, and no shame. And I just think Britain deserves better than this.
Keir Starmer there on this policy. And then I don't feel like I talk about the Liberal Democrats very much on this podcast. I realise they don't have a huge representation in Parliament, but I'll share this today. Ed Davey, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, said this.
It's clearly not going to work. There's no evidence that it will stop these appalling organised criminal gangs, these traffickers, and it's going to be incredibly expensive as well.
So some critical voices from opposition there, but, you know, I think it's important to mention that it's not like everyone in the Conservative Party is united on this. Have a listen, for example, to what Theresa May, who, of course, is a former Prime Minister, this is what she said in response to Priti Patel's address in the Commons.
Can I say with respect to my right honourable friend that from what I have heard and seen so far of this policy, I do not support the removal to Rwanda policy on the grounds of legality, practicality and efficacy. But I want to ask her about one very specific issue. I understand that those who will be removed will only be young men, that families will not be... Well, the Home Secretary is shaking her head, so I've obviously misunderstood the policy in that sense. But if it is the case that families will not be broken up, and the Home Secretary is nodding, does she not believe, and where is her evidence, that this will not simply lead to an increase in the trafficking of women and children?
Mrs. Speaker, I'm very happy to meet with the Right Honourable Lady to discuss this further and actually give her further information on this. No, actually, calm down and listen. I think first and foremost, just on the policy is legal and there's been a published MOU that speaks very, very clearly. Very clearly. Well, you're not even listening, so there's no point for it.
Theresa May there, who is kind of becoming reliably critical of the government when it comes to at least their international policies, for sure. You know, remember what she was like in response to the UK's exit from Afghanistan. So she's absolutely not afraid, even though she falls within the same party, to be extremely critical of Johnson's government. And then, of course, it's not just internally in the UK that we've seen outcry. The United Nations Refugee Agency said that the plans are, quote, unacceptable, and that the UK is trying to, quote, shift responsibility. Do you know what, actually? One thing which is, like, quite unexpected that I would ever really talk about this person on this podcast. One of the most critical statements of all came from the Archbishop of Canterbury on his Easter Sunday sermon. Have a listen to this.
The principle must stand the judgment of God, and it cannot. Subcontracting out our responsibilities, even to a country that seeks to do well, like Rwanda, is the opposite of the nature of God.
So there you go, the Archbishop of Canterbury there weighing in on this issue. So this has kind of become a bit of a row between Number 10 and the church, with Johnson turning around and saying, well, actually, the Archbishop is being, quote, unfairly critical. And then the Archbishop responded to that, saying that he would continue to speak out against this policy because he describes the need to do so as being based on moral and ethical grounds. So church and state kind of locking horns on this issue. It's interesting to see kind of who's coming out and criticising it. Okay, finally, and I know Rahana touched on this, but I just want to explore it. It's this question of, has this been done before? Because I hadn't seen it, but it did kind of get me thinking, do other countries do this? And I know she talked about that kind of Australian case study, but I just wondered if there was any more of a precedent. And like I say, when she launched it, Priti Patel described it as a, quote, global first. And by the looks of things, in lots of ways, it is. Like Rahana said, Australia do kind of offshore their asylum processing in some respects, and it's not like that hasn't fallen under immense criticism, like she outlined. But this is kind of the first time that the entire, like, operation and responsibility of doing the processing and all of that stuff has been given over to other authorities in such a large-scale way, if that makes sense. I mean, in 2015, we found this out, Israel tried a similar program where asylum seekers were given they were given like a payment and a ticket to another country, with Rwanda actually kind of believed to have been among them, but that policy was binned off after, well, you guessed it, severe criticisms from human rights activists who pointed to cases where the people involved in that scheme received extreme lack of support and often ended up back within a network of people smugglers before too long, trying to get elsewhere in their search for safety and for support. And this feeds into, you know, a wider criticism that the government has been facing, which is that Rwanda has been consistently called out, frankly, including by the UK government, for human rights abuses. And it's been widely acknowledged that it does not have a perfect track record when it comes to human rights in the country. And bear in mind, asylum seekers are often vulnerable. They're often vulnerable people who have travelled for, in many cases, a long time in extremely dire conditions from extremely dangerous situations around the world. And critics are saying that just sending them to a country with ongoing political tensions and with question marks around the safety of individuals in that country, you know, critics are saying this is negligent and irresponsible at best, and frankly, downright cruel at worst. So like I say, ministers are strongly defending the decision. They are, of course, saying that Rwanda is a safe country and it's already trusted by the UN to take in asylum seekers, particularly from Libya, for example. And plus, of course, they continue to reference that this is a solution to a concept that they, well, it was one of their manifesto pledges. We are going to clamp down in whatever means necessary on illegal immigration. So this is us just coming up with, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures. We're having to be innovative and look at solutions. And we're following through on our promise. I have never been so keen to hear about what your thoughts are on something. Frankly, in the history of this podcast, is this, in your opinion, a logical, sustainable, ethical solution to an ongoing problem, which we can all agree is a problem, where people are taking dangerous routes to get here? The solutions, the potential solutions, are so vast, but this is what the government are going for. Do you approve? Let me know. And by the way, there is a new platform in which you can communicate your feelings about these things. We are launching an Instagram account, especially for this podcast, since I am just up to my ears with a new job and a flat move in Bristol, and I just can't quite keep on top of everything. So I think it's quite nice for us to have a separate Instagram where my lovely team, the Bare Naked Politics team, are going to be helping me put that together and helping me respond to you. So let's see how that goes. You can follow it at Bare Naked Politics on Instagram. It's quite an exciting thing. Check it out, and you'll also be able to see what I look like while I'm ranting behind this microphone about what's going on in politics. So check it out. We'll be posting updates and, I think, you know, jargon busters, explainers, the rest of it. It'll be quite on brand. And also, I do want to mention that the only way really that you can guarantee this podcast can stay on and that we can kind of sustain what is becoming now a team effort is if you become a patron. So please do check the link in the episode description to support the podcast and ensure that you can keep on getting these episodes and hopefully keep on feeling informed. Of course, along with that, you can follow me at @JuliaBell_X on social media as well. I'd like to thank Hannah Anderson for producing this episode with me. And of course, thanks to Rahana for jumping on with me too. I will speak to you in the next one. Please take care of yourselves. Goodbye.